This is Paul Henley with your World Update Daily Commute, recorded on Friday at 5:30 a.m. US East Coast time. Coming up, there's further escalation in the war of words between the US and North Korea following President Trump's tightening of sanctions. How does China see things?
The president of the United States can serve the global peace interest better if he is more prudent with his words.
Young American journalists are travelling to parts of the country they've never visited in an attempt to bridge cultural divides.
Maybe I sort of look like a liberal or something. I'm just tall, I got glasses, just a nerdy-looking white guy.
And 2 days from the German elections, more criticism of Chancellor Merkel on immigration.
She was the angel who said, well, all come here. But she, in the end, was doing nothing to deal with those problems.
All after the latest world news.
BBC News with Debbie Russ. In a rare personal statement, the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has said that President Trump's recent remarks had convinced him, rather than frightening him, that the path he chose is correct, an apparent reference to the nuclear weapons program. He mocked Mr. Trump as a mentally deranged gangster. The president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, said that Tehran did not need permission from any country to bolster its missile program. Speaking at a military parade, President Rouhani said Iran would not stop boosting its military forces and would increase its military power as a deterrent. A Japanese court has ruled that a power company was responsible for the nuclear meltdown at Fukushima in 2011. However, the court dismissed government obligations to pay compensation. The court awarded more than $3 million to a group of 42 evacuees. The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, is to set out proposals she hopes will help inject new momentum into stalled negotiations about Britain leaving the European Union. She'll give a speech in Italy in which she's expected to propose a transitional deal with the EU of up to 2 years after March 2019, the date of Brexit. Turkish media say at least 4 people have drowned and up to 20 others are missing after a boat carrying migrants sank off Turkey's Black Sea coast. 38 migrants were rescued. Scientists in the United States have engineered an antibody that could offer a new way to treat or prevent HIV following successful tests on monkeys. Unlike the naturally occurring antibodies, it's built to attack 3 critical parts of the virus, making it harder for HIV to resist its effects. A cleric in Saudi Arabia, Sheikh Hajjari, has been banned from preaching after causing uproar online by suggesting that women are too stupid to drive. Women aren't permitted to drive in Saudi Arabia, although there's no formal law banning them. That's the latest BBC News.
You're listening to World Update from the BBC in London. I'm Paul Henley. Now, is it a war of words or a slanging match? The North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has described President Trump as a mentally deranged gangster. The comment came in response to Mr. Trump's warning earlier this week that the US would totally destroy North Korea and its rocket man if Pyongyang threatened the US or its allies. Former US ambassador to South Korea, Christopher Hill, told the BBC he agreed with President Trump's warning.
It's absolutely the right thing to do. I hope the Chinese get the message. They've certainly supported UN Security Council resolutions. It's important to understand that North Korea doesn't even have its own refinery capability. So when China cuts off gasoline to North Korea, that really hurts.
On Thursday, Mr. Trump announced a tightening of US sanctions against Pyongyang and praised China for its help. But what is China's view of all of this? Victor Gao is a former diplomat and Chinese government advisor with a fresh take on his country's role in the crisis. He was about to rush into a meeting and the only way we could talk to him was on a scratchy phone line. But I asked him to what extent China had to choose now between North Korea and the US.
I think China is choosing the right thing to do. That is the complete denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. And China has been standing firm to uphold and promote this principle for many years. The choice is not between DPRK and the United States. I think the United States also need to do the right thing. And for the President of the United States to threaten to destroy completely DPRK is the wrong thing to do and the wrong thing to say and the wrong thing to think about.
How far down the road of sanctions on North Korea has China actually already gone?
I think China has consistently and comprehensively implemented the sanctions approved by the United Nations Security Council. And China's stance is a simple and elegant one. That is, China will do whatever the United Nations Security Council, through its resolutions, would ask all the countries to do on the Korean Peninsula's denuclearization issue is concerned. And I think all the countries should rally behind the United Nations Security Council resolutions, and China will be no exception.
What is China's real leverage on the situation at the moment? Isn't it the case that relations between Beijing and Pyongyang are irreparably damaged now?
Indeed, there are damages in China-DPRK relations over the past several years. And the reason is because China is doing the right thing and DPRK is doing the wrong thing in further conducting nuclear weapon tests and launch vehicle tests. And China has made its view well known to the DPRK government and its leaders, and China will continue to do the right thing. And I hope eventually the leaders in DPRK will come to awakening of the reality that the nuclear weapons actually do not help their people, their government, and the only way out is through diplomacy and dialogue. And I think China will support DPRK in its attempt to do diplomacy directly with the United States.
But doing the right thing, demilitarizing the peninsula, as you put it, from China's point of view, consists of what exactly? Withdrawing its own weapons from the region? What difference does that make?
No, I think China's foreign minister, Mr. Wang Yi, has very elegantly proposed the two freezes. That is, DPRK need to freeze its nuclear weapon program and launch vehicle program.
Which has achieved precisely nothing so far.
Well, there are many cases in the world that people or governments or countries refuse to do the right thing, but eventually, by the end of the road, they need to wake up and do the right thing. And on the other hand, Foreign Minister Wang Yi also suggested that the United States and the Republic of Korea should cease joint military exercises, which constitute a threat, as far as DPRK is concerned, about their survival. So on the condition of these double freezes, hopefully the situation on the Korean Peninsula will calm down and eventually tranquility will prevail and the condition will be created so that negotiations can be started.
That was Chinese government advisor Victor Gao. The time's 37 minutes past the hour. I'm Paul Henley with World Update from the BBC. To Germany now, where millions go to the polls on Sunday. Throughout the campaign, Angela Merkel has been in a commanding position. Back in 2015, though, when she allowed more than a million migrants into the country, predictions of chaos and indeed her downfall were all about. The issue of migration has been a dominating one in this election campaign. Razia Iqbal is there for us. So, Razia, how has that been manifesting itself?
Well, you'll remember, Paul, back in 2015 when the population of Germany swelled by more than a million in the space of mere weeks, Angela Merkel said, we will manage this. Well, yesterday in Dusseldorf, she said the kinds of numbers that were coming would never happen again, that it would not be allowed to happen again. And it is true that the deal that Germany did with Turkey, or the European Union did with Turkey, has meant that the numbers coming in now are a mere trickle. But the strength of that statement in Dusseldorf yesterday could be explained by this, the emergence of the right-wing populist AfD party. Its anti-Islam and anti-immigration rhetoric has informed the political debate over the presence of migrants here, shifting mainstream opinion. There were tens of thousands of migrants who got off trains in Munich to Dortmund, where I am, in a particularly ethnically diverse part of the city. I've been speaking to the mayor of Dortmund. His name is Ulrich Sirau, and he's a member of the SPD, the most recent coalition partner of Angela Merkel's CDU.
When the people entered, we did not know who is coming here, which is one of the most discussed aspects for this right populist party, because they say, well, many, many people came here, we didn't know who's coming, and therefore nowadays we have a problem with the security in Germany. Angela Merkel concentrated on making selfies with refugees. That was her contribution to deal with that crisis. But we had to spend the nights at this railway station to take care of the refugees coming here. So she, perhaps to the world public, was the angel who said, well, all come here. But she, in the end, was doing nothing to deal with those problems. This was done by the civil society, was done by the local authorities, but not by her or by her federal minister of the interior. They didn't do anything, actually.
Okay, so they didn't do anything. They made the decision, or she made the decision, to allow as many people to come into the country.
Yeah.
Was that a mistake?
The mistake was that she was not prepared for that decision. They made a promise to those people to come here, but they didn't keep to that promise.
That was the Lord Mayor of Dortmund in Germany, Ulrich Zierau, speaking to Razia, who's still on the line. Razia, how are voters responding to frustration like that expressed by local politicians?
Well, you know, earlier on in regional elections, the AfD did very, very well in certain parts of the country, and it did feel as though their views had some traction. And in a way, you could say that that's why mainstream parties have responded and taking a slightly tougher line on issues such as deportation, the way in which migrants are being processed. But the AfD isn't resonating quite as well, although it is thought that they will have a big presence in the Bundestag post Sunday. In a way, some people are slightly nervous about the idea of voting for an extreme right populist party, but there will always be pockets of people who will not even say how they're going to vote. And in a way, that's the thing. That's the key for this election. The undecideds come Sunday. What they will decide to do will make a really big difference in terms of the makeup of the Bundestag and how Germany moves forward.
Razia Iqbal in Germany. Many thanks. When people talk, and they have a lot, about the great social divide in today's American society, the cause of a lot of anger that helped sweep President Trump to power, they often point to the media as being partly to blame. Journalists, it's claimed, have consistently overlooked the concerns of the poorest, those who are furthest from the corridors of power. Well, a new project has been launched by five young US reporters called Crossing the Divide. They're travelling across America for 3 months, some to states they've never before visited. I spoke to two of those taking part, Eric Bosco and Brittany Greeson, both 24 years old, but from very different backgrounds. I asked them to describe themselves, starting with Eric.
I'm from Massachusetts, industrial city just outside of Boston, Massachusetts. I definitely come from a middle-class family, two working parents, and I grew up in a city, you know, as a white family surrounded by a lot of immigrant populations, but definitely from a pretty liberal part of the country.
My name is Brittany Greeson. I'm from a town called Owensboro, Kentucky, which is in the northwestern part of the state along the Ohio River. My background was definitely working class. It was just me and my mom my whole life, so... You know, she was a single parent raising me, working various jobs doing so.
So tell me, Eric, if you're talking, trying to get the story of an unemployed working class person, say, in rural southern America, are there barriers that you come across? Do people sometimes react badly?
Not all the time, but I do think there are barriers as to, you know, people saying, like, well, what are you doing here? Why do you want to hear my story? But at the same time, the people down here are incredibly welcoming and incredibly forthcoming with their stories. I guess it goes both ways.
And you're in Kentucky at the moment, Brittany, on your home turf. What is the divide that you're trying to cross? Just spell it out for those who might not be familiar with it.
Basically, what it comes down to is a, you know, section of Kentucky and a section of the country that's, in a sense, felt really cut off because geographically they are. Economically, the economy has taken a downturn here. In a way, we're really trying to get in those communities and hear people's, you know, hear their perspective rather than kind of telling them what the story should be, rather, you know, being like responsible journalists.
Okay, so Eric, if I think of classic social divides in most countries, I would think along racial lines, I would think rich and poor, old and young. What's your favorite area?
Well, I think the most important one, and I think it's no coincidence that as we experience this widening income inequality and widening wealth gap in the country, we're also becoming increasingly politically divided. So that's the one that I like to focus on. We did some reporting in Massachusetts in an inner city there on our first leg of this trip, and we connected the dots between the widening income gap and the widening achievement gap in schools. And we focused on an inner city school there that was sort of underperforming and had a neighboring town with a income that increased rapidly over the past 30 years. Meanwhile, the city had a pretty stagnant and low income, and the achievement gap sort of followed that.
Tell me about a conversation you've had there. What kind of thing are you talking about?
So we had conversations with a lot of students in a pretty downtrodden high school that was a last choice for a lot of students. And we got the sentiment that these kids and parents and teachers sort of felt left behind. They felt doubted and felt cast aside by a system that really only benefited, you know, kids and people with a lot of opportunity for educational achievement, meaning kids from suburban areas with a lot more income and opportunity to have educational enrichment. And that's something that we've seen here in Kentucky, actually, and something that I find is sort of a cross-divide theme that people feel left behind. I mean, here it's the coal industry leaving towns with no jobs and no money. And in the inner city of Massachusetts, we found that people were left behind because they don't have the opportunity that suburban areas had.
Brittany, I'm guessing that you meet quite a lot of angry people.
I think that's kind of like a overdramatic narrative that's been played out, that like we're somehow in like a civil war. There's definitely been a lot of protests that have gotten out of hand, and those are kind of these heated moments. Actually, on the ground, we've encountered a lot of very welcoming people who are maybe frustrated with the media in terms of how they've presented them, but that's understandable because in the past, like, the reporting has been kind of lazy and has stuck to a lot of tropes.
Eric, forgive me for saying it, but it sounds like your job sometimes veers towards the patronizing. How do you avoid that?
I could definitely see that perception. I mean, coming from a blue state, maybe I sort of look like a liberal or something.
Do you look like a liberal?
I mean, I'm just tall. I got glasses, just a, you know, nerdy looking white guy. But, you know, I just try to listen as intently as possible and be genuine and make eye contact and spend time with people. And I think that works.
Do you think, and this is a question for Brittany, as you're from Kentucky, do you think the South in particular is misunderstood?
I think that there is a lot of stereotyping. So, you know, we have this idea that people from the South, because they speak slower or have an accent, are somehow, you know, less intelligent. And we also always attribute education to knowledge and, you know, maybe even an IQ, which is kind of like a falsehood, because there's plenty of people I know that have gone to university that, you know, still aren't critically thinking.
And Eric, if you take an overview for a moment, during the election campaign, people talked a lot about the huge gulf in understanding between Trump and Clinton supporters. Do you think now that gulf has widened? Is it better or worse?
I don't think it could get any wider than it was at that point, right? I think for better or worse, that's settled now. That game's over. And I think there's only one option but to sort of start bridging the divides and sort of start understanding each other more. I don't think there's any way we could get more polarized than that.
What's the best you can hope for from your trip, Brittany? What's the best kind of response? Something that would make you feel the whole project had been worthwhile?
I think my ideal situation would be perhaps someone calling their relative who they had disagreed with previously and starting a conversation.
That was Brittany Greeson from the state of Kentucky. Also speaking to me was Eric Bosco from Massachusetts. This is the BBC in London. The latest news headlines: the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has mocked President Trump as deranged. Bad weather is hampering the search for survivors of Tuesday's earthquake in Mexico. And an Australian man has been charged with assault after allegedly headbutting the former Prime Minister, Tony Abbott. You're listening to World Update from the BBC. My name's Paul Henley. Some international aid is beginning to reach the hundreds of thousands of Rohingyas who fled a brutal military operation in Myanmar. but nowhere near enough. Most of those who've made it to southern Bangladesh are women and children. There have been horrific accounts of violent abuses by the Burmese military, and photographic evidence shows dozens of Muslim villages have been destroyed. The government in Myanmar, however, has denied the allegations and insisted the Rohingyas burned their own homes. But our correspondent Jonathan Head was able to expose that official narrative as false when 2 weeks ago, while on a government-run tour for journalists, he witnessed local Buddhists burning a village right in front of the police. Now he's in Bangladesh and he's been to find one of the families from that village.
I'm surrounded by a sea of staring faces. Now in southern Bangladesh, this is one of so many informal camps that have just appeared in the last 3 weeks. Some of them among the trees where people are stringing lines to hang their flimsy plastic sheeting for shelter. Some of them hacked out of the hillside above rice fields. All these people, everyone around me, has come from Myanmar. But today I'm on a mission to find someone from a specific village. That's the village of Goruchara over in Rakhine State, which I filmed being set alight just 2 weeks ago. Well, we just walked into this village. We saw a massive column of smoke appear over the rice fields. We've come into it. It has literally just been set alight. So we're off now through the squelching rice fields to meet a man whose family have come from Goruchara. There's a group of men just in front of me, and we think he's one of them. Well, we've just been looking at the map on my iPhone, and I've expanded it so he can see the shape of Goruchara. His name's Abdul Majid, and he's absolutely sure that's where he comes from. He's identified the bridge going over the river just before the village. So we're going to go up to his house or whatever shelter he's got here to see his family. Right, well, we're going up a hill now. All around me, people are putting up shelters. Well, they're just frames, really, made of split bamboo. That's all people live under here. You can see this was a kind of scrub-covered hillside. There was nothing here 2 weeks ago. People are banging bits of wood and splitting bamboo and putting it together. The plastic sheeting they sleep under is just as thin as a bin liner. It's hard to see that keeping out the monsoon rains. But that's what thousands and thousands of Rohingyas have as a shelter now. And just following Abdul Majid now, we're going down. I can see his house in front of us, the same kind of shelter, and it's literally on the side of a hill. Well, we're sitting inside this very hot, steamy shelter. There's no breeze inside. The plastic sheeting is constantly flapping. Abdul Majid just said it actually blows away in the storms. He has to reattach it. He's just been showing me a pile of Burmese money. It's all he's got, all he's brought with him. It's worth about 70 pence. I'm going to sit down now with him and open my laptop and show him the video that I filmed of his village when it was on fire.
Tea shop.
Yeah.
Tea shop.
Mm.
That was the tea shop.
Yeah.
So they recognize the tower. Yeah. Yeah. So these people are seeing their village burning for the first time after they left it. And they now know what happened to it.
So that was amazing. As we played that video, Abdul Majid was quite excitedly pointing to buildings he recognised. And actually, if you look at his face now, you can really see it's had quite an effect on him watching this. He'd run away from the village before it was burnt.
Even if they gave us a sack full of money, we wouldn't choose to stay here. If they didn't shoot us in Myanmar and there was peace, we would go back right away. We're not happy being here. We're not here for the food, but only to save our lives.
So there's a real sense of completion now. When I saw that burning village, I so wondered what had happened to its inhabitants, really feared for them. It's in some ways wonderful to meet someone who escaped and has come over here and is with his family, and yet at the same time, when you look at what he's got and his prospects, there's so little help for these people, so little future. Bangladesh doesn't want them. Abdul-Majid is quite desperate. He says he doesn't want to live here. He doesn't want to stay. He just can't go back.
Jonathan Head in Bangladesh. Now, to finish the programme, let's return to a talking point around one of our main stories today. The English-speaking world has found itself suddenly reacquainted with a 14th-century term, dotard, thanks to an unlikely source, the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The term was directed at US President Donald Trump and can be defined as meaning an old person, especially one who's become weak or senile, or an imbecile. But some observers are debating whether Mr. Kim really meant to use that term. Joining us now is Dr. Justina Robinson, Senior Lecturer in English Language and Linguistics at the University of Sussex here in the UK. She speaks four languages, Polish, her native tongue, Russian, French and luckily English. Welcome to the programme, Dr. Robinson. What did you think of the use of this term, dotard?
Good morning. The first thing I thought about is that they use the antiquated English without perhaps realizing that. They use the phrase or term here that is not in common usage in current English. You see, most of learners of English as a foreign language use printed resources that obviously present English with a time delay. English is changing as we speak. But the resources are need to be written and edited and printed, and they need to travel to different parts of the world. So they fossilize English in a form that was relevant of the time where the project was conceived.
So in this case, perhaps the translator toned down the insult. How about this for toning down something? This is another quote from President Trump in a UN General Assembly speech on Iran this time. He said, "The Islamic Republic of Iran has turned a wealthy country with a rich history and culture into an economically depleted rogue state whose chief exports are violence, bloodshed and chaos." Translated for consumption in Iran, this became, in our opinion, life for Iranians could be better. There's a lot to be said for a doctored translation sometimes.
OK, two things might have happened here. I worked as a simultaneous interpreter in the past, and what happens at those really important debates is that sometimes you need to just convey the gist of the message in the interpretation before you start losing what the following sentences are. So perhaps the translator, the interpreter here, just did that.
Or perhaps he was wielding more power than he should have had. I've had a Kurdish translator refuse to translate my questions in Turkey because he thought they were inappropriate. It's not really the role, or is it?
No, it's not the role of the interpreter. So this is a personal decision. I can't comment on that. If this was a not fully professional interpretation, that's the interpreter to account for.
But the responsibility must weigh heavily on you when you're doing simultaneous translation, does it?
Absolutely. And you are there to facilitate conversation. And actually, what happens if you interpret for a long time, you switch off your own thinking. You are almost like a machine. So sometimes when I do it for an hour or two, and then somebody asks me about the content of the conversation, I really can't remember details because you are just like a human machine that is interpreting.
Justina, so, thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
Justina Robinson, Senior Lecturer in English Language and Linguistics from the University of Sussex. Thanks to you for listening to this edition of World Update. Join us next time from the whole team for now. Bye-bye.